Welcome, everybody. This is the second office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention, where we're covering the third of the textbook Lessons for the Young Economist. Today is May 3rd, 2014, in case anyone discovers this centuries in the future and wants to know. Okay, so as always for these office hour sessions, for those of you who are tuned in live, go ahead and fire away in the, you can go ahead and type it right in the chat box, since it's more manageable on these office hour sessions. While people are thinking, let me elaborate on something that I was saying at the end of the lecture, but by all means, for those of you who are tuned in live here, don't think you're interrupting me or something. Go ahead and post your questions, and that'll help me pace myself. But let me just give a little bit more, because we're kind of rushed for time. And so this is, I'm not going to quiz you guys on this stuff in case you're taking the course for credit, but let me try to give you the big picture. So it has to do with what's called tax reform, and there's a usual or a typical way that economists approach tax policy design, or should I say tax policy or tax design, and it's what you might call the theory of optimal taxation. Now, to a hardcore Rothbardian, that sounds like a contradiction in terms. Or you would say, yeah, the optimal tax is zero. And, okay, fair enough. But let me just give you the logic so you at least you understand what these people mean by that. And it'll help clarify. So then when you know what standard mainstream economists mean when they talk like this, then that might shed some more light on the reaction that Murray Rothbard gave that I also touched on right at the end of the lecture. So the idea is, not all taxes are created equal. And I think that's a useful point, that you should not, the way you evaluate a tax system is not merely to say, how much money are they taking? Right? So you don't want to just say, oh, in country A, they take in, you know, they tax 20% of GDP. In country B, they tax 26% of GDP. So therefore, the tax burden must be heavier in country B. That's not necessarily true, okay? And just more generally, to think of taxation, and if you're thinking of it as, oh, yeah, they're just sucking money out of the economy so the government can spend it, and that's your gauge of how destructive it is, that's not the right way to think about it, okay? So there's a couple different techniques you can do or illustrations I can give you to get the idea across, but what I gave you in the live lecture last time was to say, you could imagine a tax that is so punitive that it doesn't raise very much revenue at all for the government. But it would be wrong to conclude that, oh, therefore it must not be a very distorting tax because they're not sucking up. It's the other way around. It's so distorting that it actually is destroying the underlying tax base. All right, so pick an income tax. If the government kept raising the percentage tax rate, the amount of your taxable income that they said you owe the IRS at the end of the year, eventually you'd surpass what's called the Laffer point, at which raising the tax rate, the percentage, would mean fewer total dollars in tax receipts would go to the government each year. And so what's happening there is that people are reacting to the tax code. And so somebody who originally was going to work a lot, like take a job as a lawyer and get paid $200,000 a year when the tax rate was 50%, if the government raised the tax rate to 95%, that person might say, well, whoa, I'm not going to bust my butt, work 85-hour weeks and be all stressed out all the time. If I only get to keep 5% of the money, I'll just go work at the library and have a much, you know, more peaceful job, do something that I like doing. I love working with books or reading to the little kids on Saturdays or whatever it is. And yeah, I'm not going to have that much money, but it's the reduction in my take-home pay is going to be smaller because the tax rate's so high. That's one way to think about it. That if you go from having a job that pays before taxes $40,000 a year to one that pays $200,000 a year without tax considerations, that's a lot of money. And so maybe the extra $160,000 a year would make it worthwhile for you to have the real stressful job working in the corporate law office as opposed to being a librarian. But if the government has a ridiculously high tax rate, like 95%, well, then you only actually get to take home 5% of that extra $160,000. And so, what is that, $8,000? So yeah, so the question to the person is, for an extra $8,000 a year take-home pay, would you want to have the really super stressful job or just a job that's doing what you love? You would take the stressful job for $160,000 more per year, but you wouldn't do it for $8,000 more per year. Okay, so what does all that mean? I'm trying to boil down the individual micro decision. Okay, now in the aggregate, that means if a lot of people are making decisions like that, or there's other stuff too, like capital gains taxes, typically, or at least in the United States, I don't know about other countries, but you pay your income tax when the capital gain is realized very often. And so if you buy some stocks at $10 a share and year after year they tend to be going up, you don't keep paying the IRS and settling up because of that capital gain. No, usually what happens is when you finally sell them, then at that point they look at the records and say, what was your capital gain over the time of you holding it, and now you settle the IRS. And so, and you see a very clear response in the data when they lower capital gains tax rates, there's a huge surge in reported capital gain income to the IRS. And vice versa, when they jack up the capital gains tax rate, the amount of total reported capital gains falls off a cliff. And so that, well, clearly what's happening is that people react strategically to tax code. So it's not that they're lying, by the way. They're not cheating on their taxes. That you're allowed to do that. The point is, if you know the government is going to say to you, okay, figure out what your capital gain was. What was the price of the stock when you got in? What was the price when you sold? And then that difference is your capital gain on that stock. And then you owe us some percentage of that gain as a capital gains tax. Well, you don't have to sell. And so if they just jacked up the tax rate, you don't have to sell. You can just hold it and hope that they're going to lower the tax rate at some point. And then you get in and sell in that brief window. Or another thing that happens is if they announce that the capital gains tax rate is going to go up like on January 1st, then people might sell in December. You know what I mean? Like to get out before the rates get jacked up. And so you'll see that kind of pattern too, where there'll be a bunch of activity right before there's a ratcheting up of the punishment. Okay, so I'm just warming you guys up here, repeating a lot of the stuff or elaborating the stuff I said. So what that means is economists, you know, mainstream economists are not stupid. They understand that kind of stuff. And so you can see because people respond to incentives like that, there's actually situations where everybody, if the purpose of taxation is to raise money for the government, then some types of tax structures are so ridiculously inefficient that not only is it bad for the people in the private sector, it actually is bad for the government. And so that's what mainstream economists mean by studying tax policy and promoting efficient tax reform and stuff like that. And that's why the benchmark in those kind of analyses is what's called a revenue neutral tax reform. Meaning, how can we redesign the structure of the tax code such that the total number of dollars or euros or whatever, depending on what country you're in, flowing to the government in terms of tax receipts is unchanged? Okay, because obviously, you can promote economic growth and you can make people in the private sector richer by just cutting taxes overall. That's obvious. But what's less obvious is to say, is there a way that we can change the tax code so that people in the private sector are better off? They feel like the government's taking less from them, and the government doesn't see a drop in its revenue. So that seems like a win-win or a win-tie. So that's why they do that. It's because, in other words, they don't want to encounter any obstacles, political resistance, that in principle, if you're an economist and come along and look at the tax code and say, holy cow, this tax code is so stupidly designed that if we just change X, Y, and Z, everybody either pays, I'm sorry, everybody feels better in terms of that they feel like it's a better deal. They would prefer that facing that tax code. And the government's receipts didn't go down. And so it's not like the deficit goes up or that we have to cut government spending anyway. So nobody should be against that except the people who prepare taxes for a living. Because then, you know, they have less work if the tax code gets simplified. Okay, so that's the idea. So that's where that idea comes from, and that's why in that kind of analyses, revenue neutrality is a benchmark. It doesn't mean you have to insist on that. You could just say, and incidentally, I think the government takes too much money anyway, and so in addition to whatever, going to a flat tax where revenue neutrality would require a flat tax of 22%, beyond that, let's cut it to 18%. So not only is the tax code more efficient in terms of raising a given number of dollars, but let's raise fewer dollars. There's nothing preventing somebody from saying that, but I'm just saying they typically want to isolate the effects of what they're doing. They want to say they want to highlight just how crazy the current tax code is by showing, look at, we could effectively give everybody a humongous tax cut from their perspective and yet not sacrifice any revenue. So why don't we do that? That's the idea. So given that that's the way most economists discuss tax reform, that's why Rothbard, when he talks about it, often will stress the idea and say, why do we just take it as a given that the government is entitled to the current amount of revenue that it's taking in? An economist, you know, should, instead of brainstorming about, well, gee, how can we tinker with the tax code to lighten the burden on the oppressed masses and the beleaguered taxpayer, but we take it as a constraint, as one of the ground rules in our thinking, oh, the government can't see any drop in revenue, but that would, you know, meet with resistance. Rothbard thinks that's silly, that we're playing another game, and that, you know, the important thing is lowering the tax receipts, or not that's the important thing, but that why in the world would you concede that the government is entitled to how much revenue it's currently getting? Okay, so I think I clarified that. You guys have posted a bunch of questions, so I'll turn to those now. Don says, since there are no completely free market economies and only a handful of socialist communist economies, is the distinction of interventionist economies only useful as a teaching tool? Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So just, let me just paraphrase and make sure everyone gets it. So in the textbook, and then what we've been doing if you've been taking these online classes with me, is we break up the discussion. First, in the textbook, there was just core foundational principles of economic science. Then the first object of our study using this economic science was to study the hypothetical purely free market economy, where we assumed that everybody respected property rights, there was no government, and we just everything was voluntary, and people freely exchanged their property against each other, and we just spun out the implications of that kind of world to see how would prices be formed, how would capital goods get allocated across different sectors, what would set wage rates, that sort of thing. Then we'd study pure socialism or command economy, and now what we're doing for the remainder of this course is we're studying what's called interventionism, or what some people call the mixed economy. So Don is saying, in the real world, there is no such thing, you know, there would be nothing that you would classify as a purely free market economy, and there's actually very few places that now we would classify as outright pure socialism. So just about every government on Earth right now, at least, would be classified as a system of intervention, except maybe like North Korea, possibly Cuba, and I'm not sure about Venezuela. I'd have to go look and see exactly what they're doing down there to make a call on that one. So I think, Don, that you anticipated my answer. It is for analytical purposes, you need to have those distinctions in mind. And in particular, Mises had a great point on this very question. In Human Action, he brings it up that some people objected to the study of the pure market economy and accused economists of smuggling in their value judgments and saying, you economists, you're studying this unrealistic thing that doesn't exist in the real world because you're trying to subconsciously get your students to, you know, adhere to that sort of vision. You know, so it's propaganda. And Mises responded to that criticism, and he said, no, that's the necessary way to proceed in economics. He said, even Marxists or socialists do the same thing. He said, in order for you, or even interventionists do the same thing. He said, in order for you to explain, like let's say you're in favor of the government coming in and setting regulations on food safety. Mises is saying, in order for you to justify those regulations, you have to paint two pictures. You have to say, on the one hand, this is what the world would look like if we didn't have any safety regulations or any regulations on food. If we just had a total free, anarchistic, free market, laissez-faire outcome, this is what would happen. And if you're in favor of those regulations, you probably would be painting a picture of people getting food poisoning all the time. You go down to the restaurant and you barf it in the street and so on. Everybody's keeling over and dying because everything in the store is poisonous. And then you contrast that with, now what if we have wise government intervention to set minimum standards and we're sending around food inspectors and fining companies if they don't have pure products and so forth. Right? Or, you know, so any kind of government regulation or even outright socialism, Mises is saying the people in favor of those policies also engage in the very same type of analysis that I'm doing, or the technique is the same. They contrast, this is what would happen under pure laissez-faire capitalism. This is what would happen under my proposal. It's just where they differ is not in the technique. It's just in the actual content of the analysis. All right, so yes, Don, to answer your question, the reason we do that is not because there really is such a thing out there in the real world right now, at least, that we would classify as a fully free market economy, but it's that in order for us to understand the effects of government intervention, we need to have a baseline. Right, so in order to understand what the minimum wage does, which we just covered this week, you have to first know what the market clearing wage is. You have to have that concept in your mind in order to then understand, okay, the market clearing wage would have been $6 an hour, and now they impose a minimum wage of $8 an hour, what happened? If you had no idea of being able to say what would the baseline default be if there were no minimum wage, it's kind of tricky to then say, well, what happens if there is a minimum wage? Okay. Let's see. I'll come back to the other question in a minute, Don, because we have other people chiming in here. Jed asks or says, I didn't get around to reading it, but I think there was a recent Mises Daily article at Mises.org, the gist of which was that Sweden has been undergoing reforms because it is not the workers' paradise some thought it to be. Are you familiar with that article? Can you comment? It's funny, Jed, I think I'm in the same boat that you are. I saw it and thought, you know, I should really read that, and then I never came back to it. Are you – the other thing, too, is PER, P-E-R, Bylund, I don't know, I'm probably butchering his last name, B-Y-L-U-N-D. I think he recently was in the Wall Street Journal, actually, talking about healthcare in his country and because a lot of people who support the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, were pointing to his country as, you know, the ideal, and why can't we be more like that? And so he was explaining that no, it's actually a myth. But everyone's saying how it's all roses over there. But unfortunately, Jed, I didn't read it either, so I can't give any more specifics. Jan asks, when some economists produce studies claiming that the minimum wage does not cause unemployment, how is it possible that they get this result empirically? Also, how do they theoretically explain it? Okay, great question. I could literally go on for an hour on this one, so I won't. I'll try to ration my time. But let me first, I can't remember if I gave it to you guys in the syllabus or not. But I recently, so I'm just playing with Econ Lib, Robert Murphy, minimum wage. I recently did an Econ Lib article on just this topic. So here, I'm finding it for you who are tuned in. I'll post it in the. So it's for those who are just hearing this later, it's called Economists Debate the Minimum Wage. It was February 3rd, 2014, the Econ Lib featured article of the month, if you're familiar with that series. So here, well, I just grabbed it, I'll post it in the thing here. So let me, I'll boil it down quickly. So literally textbook economics, not just Austrian stuff, not even just free market books, but in general, economists have been pretty good knowing that explicit price controls are a very clumsy way to try to intervene in the market. All right, so even, well, I imagine, like, well, you know, I say that, but then you probably are thinking, well, then how come we've had the minimum wage for so long? And I don't have a great answer for you on that. I think just because it's so popular that no politician was going to get rid of it. Kind of like with free trade. For a while, I'm making these numbers up, but I think they're roughly correct. Let's say from like the year 1890 through 1950, I think if you polled economists and said right now, up or down, vote, you can either have, you know, your country can get rid of all tariffs or keep them how they are right now. What do you want to do? I bet you over 90% of the economists would say just get rid of all the tariffs. Okay, I'm totally making that up, but I think that that's correct. In more recent years, things have changed. All right, so let me just focus now on the minimum wage. So it's a similar thing with the minimum wage. I think the consensus truly was, and again, I don't just mean among Chicago school or Austrians, I mean among it, people with a PhD in economics. The consensus was that yes, imposing a minimum wage, especially the higher you raised it relative to what the market clearing wage would have been, will cause unemployment among unskilled laborers, particularly teenagers. And so at best, you have to balance the loss to those people against the gains to the people who retain their jobs and get higher wages. And then empirically, so that's the theory, and that's in textbook, literally textbook analysis, like the kind that I gave you guys, that's, you know, that would be in textbooks going way back since when they had supply and demand curves. Now, and then empirically, that seemed to be totally borne out by the data, that they ran regressions and stuff from like the 1950s up through, I want to say like the early 1980s. Give or take, and yeah, and just shown through the data that yep, we've run analyses controlling for a few other variables and stuff, and there seems to definitely be statistically significant empirical evidence that, because what would happen is U.S. states might have different policies, so it's not that every area in the United States is subject only to the federal government's minimum wage, but states are allowed to set their own statewide minimum wages. In some states, imposed a minimum wage that was higher than the federal minimum. So everybody, of course, has to comply with the federal law. But if you happen to be in a state that has a more aggressive policy, well, then your minimum wage is even higher. Okay, so that gave a lot of variability in the data. But if one state raises its minimum wage, then that should be an experiment, if you will, and you should be able to see, okay, well, what happened to the employment, like among fast food workers in that state relative to other states. Okay, so the point is, over decades, and there's a lot of data on employment in the fast food industry, and the reason, of course, they focus on the fast food industry is that's where there's a lot of employment of low-skilled labor. So if they raise the minimum wage, you probably wouldn't expect to see law firms laying off a lot of people, but you might see impacts among Burger King and McDonald's. Okay. So, like I say, it looked like the evidence matched the textbook theory, and that was the consensus for decades, and the only thing to quibble over was the quantitative relationship. Like, if you raise the minimum wage by 10%, what is the actual quantitative impact on employment? But there was little doubt that there was an impact. It was just a matter of, well, how bad is it going to be? Okay. Then that started to get challenged, I think, in the early 90s. Once these new techniques, and I'll very briefly describe these new techniques, and then I'll move on to the next question. What happened was, and then once these new techniques started picking up steam, then things just got out of hand, and such that now you've got a lot of economists, certainly Paul Krugman and guys like that, claiming that the consensus has been flipped and saying now the burden of proof is on you if you want to say the minimum wage actually reduces unemployment. Okay, so there's three points I want to make, and I summarize, or I go through this more quickly in that Econ Lib article. The first point is, or the first two points, let me just stipulate that all the new evidence, empirical studies are correct. We'll come back to that on point number three, but right now let's just assume that they're all correct, and it really is the case that empirically, raising the minimum wage in the past has not significantly impaired the growth of employment. And incidentally, it's not really in the data what you're looking at. It's not saying if they raise the minimum wage, did a bunch of people get laid off? Rather, what they look at is because over time, population's growing, and you know, the economy's growing and wages grow, that sort of thing. So really what they were looking at is how fast was the employment in the fast food industry growing before, and then if they hike the minimum wage, would that slow the rate of growth? So they're looking and seeing it, you know, the growth of employment is typically the important thing. It's not that all of a sudden a bunch of people literally get thrown out of work. It's rather going forward, is it harder for new people to get hired? So, okay, let's just stipulate that that's all correct. And so I have two responses. One is, even if that is true, all these economists, these progressive economists who are therefore saying, yeah, sure, the White House proposal to raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, up from the current $7.25, I think, that still wouldn't follow. Those guys are completely full of crap, excuse my French. Okay, because the studies that have been done were never on a hike of that significance. All right, that's a big raise to go from seven. I think it's 7.25 to 10.10. That's a very large percentage increase. And so the empirical study documenting apparently there's a very weak relationship at all between employment and hikes in the minimum wage. The stuff they were looking at were not 41%, something like that, hikes. They weren't that high. Okay, so even if you thought those studies were perfect and were telling the real story, it would not follow that therefore what the White House is proposing to do is a good idea. I mean, just to exaggerate it, if the White House raised the minimum wage to $100 an hour, even Paul Krugman would say, okay, yeah, that's going to throw a lot of unskilled people out of work. So what they've been saying is, the data show that a modest hike in the minimum wage doesn't affect employment. And that, you know, Sean Hannity and all these right-wing blowhards are just bluffing. They don't know what the data show. And then he goes right around and says, so therefore, the president's proposal is fine. And I'm saying, no, that doesn't work. It's not a modest hike in the minimum wage to raise it from $7.25 to $10.10. That's a big hike. Okay, so that's one thing. Another thing is, and this is what I showed you guys in the lecture this week, even if, or you can draw a really steep demand curve to try to illustrate the results that they're claiming to follow. So that if you have a really steep demand curve for unskilled labor, then that would show that for, you start with the original intersection point, and that's equal to market clearing wage. And then if you had a modest hike in the wage because of the minimum wage floor, that wouldn't drastically reduce the overall quantity of employment. And that's the variable they're looking at. But what would still happen is you would suck a lot of more people into the market looking for work. And so unemployment would go up and the unemployment rate would go up. And you do see that in the data, right? The unemployment rate among unskilled people, like if you look at the BLS data for unemployment, as you break it down into the categories, the unemployment rate among teenagers, especially teenagers who are minorities, is way higher than for the general public. Right. So that's still the case. And so all the points we made about how wage floors cripple the market's ability to allocate resources still kicks in. So yeah, it's true. If they hike the minimum wage, maybe you don't see that big of an effect on the total number of people working at McDonald's. But the particular people who are working at McDonald's might be drastically different. It might be a bunch of college kids who are taking part-time jobs because, oh, making $10.10 an hour, that's not too bad. And they're displacing a bunch of people who are less skilled but needed to work more. But the employer is like, well, if I got to pay $10.10 an hour, I'm going to pick these kids over here. And so you might not see a huge drop in the total number of people on the payroll, but there would be a big turnover over who was on the payroll. Okay, so I'm saying that element is totally consistent with all these revisionist studies that Krugman and so forth are pointing to show, oh, see, minimum wage doesn't do anything bad. That, no, it might be doing just what I said. Okay, last point, tackling head on. You know, is it correct? Are these empirical studies actually finding? Unfortunately, I could not drill down and get so comfortable that I could definitively tell you guys one way or the other, that I am still not sure. So I can tell you what these I'll call revisionist studies are claiming to find. It's they're saying that, let me just give you one example. What they're saying is that historically, the empirical studies that seem to confirm the textbook intuition, remember up through at least like the early 80s, the empirical studies of the minimum wage did seem to show that, you know, in terms of regression analysis, yeah, you hike the minimum wage and that has a statistically significant negative impact on employment. These revisionist studies that started coming out like in the early 1990s, they were saying what's going on there is they're mistaking correlation with causation. There's actually other factors in play that those regression earlier studies were overlooking. So, for example, one thing might be it just so happens, for whatever reason, that southern states tend to be more conservative politically than North states in the Northeast or something, California. And so if a lot of people are moving to Texas and Florida because of the weather or other factors like that, then they're going to see faster growth. And so if it just so happens that Texas and Florida don't raise their minimum wage, whereas New York does, then the state of Washington or something, okay, then you would tend to see, it would look like, oh, wait a minute, states that raise their minimum wage don't see as fast growth in unskilled employment as states that don't raise their minimum wage. But they're saying it's not because, or it might not be just because of the minimum wage, it might be other factors, and it's just, it's for whatever reason, there seems to be this packing of states that don't raise their minimum wage that are attractive on other reasons. Okay, so that's the idea of what's going on. And there are some that claim, there are some studies that try to do a much more controlled experiment, and they look at counties. So they have county level data. So, you know, not statewide, but breaking it down even smaller at the county level. And so what they want to try to find is two adjacent counties that fall on opposite sides of the state border. Everyone get that? And so you would think they would be quite similar because they're right next to each other geographically. But, you know, so you could drive 5 minutes and be in one county, drive 5 minutes and be in the other county. But the point is one county happens to be in one state and the other county happens to be in a different state. So then they're saying we can find cases where one of those states raises its minimum wage but the other one doesn't. Well, then that's a pretty good controlled experiment because a lot of these other things should be equal. It can't be that the weather's different if they're adjacent counties, that kind of stuff. All right, so the claim is that doing these things that if I described it to you and didn't tell you what the answer was, and you know, told you the experimental design, you would probably pick that one and say, yeah, that seems like it's a much more controlled experiment, and I would much, you know, I would think that design would much better isolate the true impact of just the change in the minimum wage, whereas these other experimental designs, there's a lot of other moving parts that could be obscuring the actual pure effect of the minimum wage hike. And believe it or not, the studies that seem to be more correctly designed are the ones showing there's not that big of an impact. All right, so that's, and then, you know, there are economists who have responded to that, those new revisionist studies and tried to point out what's wrong with them and blah, blah, blah. But like I said, I went into it hoping I would be able to just say, aha, no, they're doing something really wrong here at step three. And I never quite got to that level of understanding because it's pretty technical. You have to know a lot of econometrics. So anyway, that's where it stands. So if you want to see more, look at that EconLib article that I pointed, and there's all kinds of citations, and you can go read the actual article and get a sense of it. So just to be clear, not to mislead anyone, I am not saying, yeah, guess what, guys, in the real world, hiking the minimum wage doesn't actually do anything. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying, though, is I can understand why if you, like guys like Krugman, who want to be in favor of raising the minimum wage, they would love it if it didn't have a negative impact. I can understand why they think they're being intellectually honest by saying it doesn't, because prima facie, there are a lot of these papers published in top econometric type journals that look like, huh, imagine that. So, I mean, a lot of the opposition to it is just to say, what? That's crazy. That can't possibly be right. You get what I'm saying? So in other words, if it had been the other way around, if these newly designed studies had shown that raising the minimum wage reduces unemployment, yeah, I think most economists wouldn't be questioning the design. They would say, well, yeah, duh. It's only that, what the heck? Like, it's so at odds with what you would expect theoretically. Because, I mean, think about what we're saying. They're saying you can raise the price of something significantly and that won't make employers buy less of it. So it's saying the law of demand is true for unskilled labor. So why would you think that? That doesn't make any sense. That's kind of what's going on here, but like I say, I did not get into the nitty gritty enough to be able to definitively say, yeah, those new studies are just nuts. Okay, Don, let's go back to Don here. He says, what about the argument that since the vast majority of people have to work to survive, if you raise their taxes by 5% more than they pay now, they will just work harder to maintain their standard of living rather than taking more leisure. Okay, that's a good point. So, yes, it is true that one of the offsetting factors or forces when you're doing the analysis of a tax increase is, well, it's what's called the substitution income effects. And so, yeah, when you raise the income tax percentage rate, you, on the margin, make leisure more attractive than work compared to what they were before. You know, you've increased the penalties of work, or you've reduced the benefit of working. All right, so you've made leisure artificially more attractive. But, like you say, by making people poorer, you also increase how much they want to earn that extra dollar. And so that's what's called the income. So the substitution effect is the issue of changing the relative price. So you've made the price of leisure go down, but you've, on the other hand, taken income away from the person. So you've made them want income more than they did before. So it's an empirical question of how that plays out. The other thing, though, is which we did not get into in this last lecture, but is a relevant factor in the real world, is at some point people just break the law. Right? So if you impose draconian income tax rates, a lot of people will just start working under the table. You know, they'll do jobs and get paid cash and not report the income. So that's another reason that in the real world, the higher the government raises the income tax rates, the lower or the bigger the drop in the reported tax base. It's not necessarily that people really aren't working, it's that they're working and not getting paid or they are getting paid with checks, but they're just not reporting it on their taxes every year. And so from the government's perspective, getting these reports, it looks like total taxable income went down or didn't grow as fast as otherwise would have. So that's one issue too, Don. Okay. Michael says, are the effects of a value-added tax the same as those of sales taxes? Well, first of all, let me explain to everybody what a value-added tax is. So these are popular in Europe, and they're called a VAT, for VAT, the value-added tax, the acronym. And the idea is, it kind of goes back, if you've taken another typical economics class where there's different stages, so the standard example, it's when they show you how GDP is computed. You might have seen this kind of analysis before, where they say, okay, producing $100 worth of bread at the retail level, so the consumers go to the store and they buy loaves of bread, and the consumers are buying $100 worth. Well, you go back one stage, and the baker buys $80 worth of flour and pays, you know, some or gets paid wages of $15, and so that's $95 of value. And then there's $5 from the capitalist, the interest income going from that stage to the retail. Okay, so the idea is, of the $100 in value of the bread, of the final bread, that's loaves of bread for the consumer, $80 of it was contributed by the flour, $10 was the labor of the baker, and $5 was interest in, or I'm getting mixed up now. $15 was the labor. It's supposed to add up. I'm forget what numbers I just threw up. But you get the idea. And you keep going back stage after stage. And so the $80 of value that was the flour, where does that come from? Oh, you go back one stage to the miller. And the miller, what did he do? Well, he didn't just create $80 of flour from a vacuum. He's not a magician. No, he had to get wheat from the farmer. And so he spent $60 buying the wheat from the farmer. Okay. So the idea is, each stage, you can see how much value was added. because they're, you know, they, at each stage, the way you figure out the value of what's being created is how much do the customers at that level spend on the goods and services. And then you ask the people who are selling them, what did they pay in explicit monetary costs for their factors of production? And there's going to be a gap. And so that gap is the value that's added at that stage. And so what a value-added tax does is tax, at each stage, taxes on that increment. All right, so, and so the way that's actually designed in practice is you get taxed, you know, based on the percentages applied to the receipts, you know, that you get from selling your revenue, selling to your customer, but then you get to fully deduct your expenses. Because, you know what I'm saying? So if you're the baker and you spend, what did I say, $80 on the flour and you spend $15 on the workers who are actually, like, actually baking the stuff, then, you know, that's $95 or whatever I said. And so then you get to deduct that. So you only pay it on the five. All right. So in principle, so you could do it that way, or you could just apply the same tax percentage at the final level, just on that final sale price. Okay. So instead of, let's say the tax rate is 5%, you could apply the 5% at each level. So when the farmers harvest the wheat and then go sell it to the miller. The miller, you come in and tax the miller 5% right there. And then when the miller turns around and sells the flour to the baker, you charge the baker 5% right there for the gap, and so on. You could do it that way. Or you could just go at the retail level. And when those loaves of bread get sold for $100 to consumers, you could just slap the 5% tax on that full $100 right there, and that's it. Okay, so either way, in theory, it's the same. It should give you the same number, because you could either apply the percentage at the increment at each level, and so, you know, if you think about it, the increment at each level added up is the total number at the bottom, or you could just apply it once at the bottom for the whole thing with no deductions. All right, so that's the logic by which you might often see economists interchangeably advocate a retail sales tax or a VAT or what they might call a consumption tax. And so that's where they're coming from, you know, in theory, appropriately designed, those are all supposed to be taxes on consumption. In practice, I think that they do differ just because of the vagaries of the tax code and people can game the system. So, like, because you think about, like, how did that come in? Well, what if you're a business that's buying computers to use in your business? Well, then you should be able to deduct those. If there's a VAT, you should be able to deduct those, right? So if you're a business, I don't know, giving people, doing accounting services for your customers. And so your customer comes in and submits their QuickBooks file, and you're doing the accounting or whatever, to give them recommendations or to do their books, whatever. And so you buy computers for that business. When you're getting the VAT assessed on you, while you're selling, you look at the receipts that your customers are paying, and then you get to deduct the full value of those computers you bought. But if instead of that you just do a sales tax on the computers, well, strictly speaking, that's not the same thing, right? So, you know, I mean, if all computer sales now are considered retail, and then some businesses buying computers, even though they're a factor of production for whatever it's producing, well, then that's not the same thing. Okay, so like I say, in principle, in theory, you can design them so that they're equivalent. But in practice, it's going to make a difference whether you have a sales tax or that, or try to directly measure people's consumption. That's the other thing too. Like one way of designing the consumption tax levied at the individual level is to say it's like an income tax. So you report your total income, but then you get to fully deduct your savings because you know, your income minus savings is your consumption. So if you make $100,000 a year and you report that, and let's say the tax rate's 20%, then right now you owe $20,000, but then if you put $50,000 of it into your mutual fund, you get to fully deduct that. And so now your taxable income is only $50,000, well, it's your taxable consumption. And then you only pay the percentage on that. Okay, so that's a lot of economists favor that kind of system, at least in principle, because they, if you think about it, if you're fully deducting what you save, clearly that system is going to promote saving vis-a-vis a system where no, you earn income and you pay tax on it, whether you save it or consume it. It doesn't favor saving as much. Okay, so that's, now you see the other thing that I talked about when I was talking about Rothbard at the end of the last lecture, where he thinks sometimes these mainstream economists are sloppy and they will say the tax code ought to be promoting saving and investment because that causes economic growth. When, no, why should that? That'd be like saying the tax code ought to promote people eating apples. Why? The tax code shouldn't be promoting saving. There's, people have time preferences and people should save at that level that is consistent with their time preferences. And the government shouldn't be promoting it, but it also shouldn't be penalizing it. All right. So, in fairness, the income tax really does penalize savings. Okay, so it's actually not neutral. But Rothbard is definitely right. So what I'm saying is, you could correctly say a consumption tax does not penalize savings the same way that an income tax does. So on that criterion alone, if we don't think about anything else, a consumption tax would be less distorting than an income tax. But Rothbard is right when he says a lot of economists take what I just said, which is technically correct, and they say something that's not quite right when they're trying to dumb it down for the masses and make it look like we're sitting at home at night hoping people save more, when strictly speaking as economists, that we don't have any grounds for that value judgment. Just like economic science doesn't say it would be really good if people spent less on cigarettes and spent more on Brussels sprouts. You might think that personally, that might fit with your own moral code, your own view of the good society or the good life, but you can't say that economics is people spending money on cigarettes is inefficient. No, economic science doesn't say that. If that's what people's preferences are, economics can't say that. And so a government tax code that taxes cigarettes really highly and doesn't tax Brussels sprouts, that would make consumers worse off using standard economic analysis. Okay, I've got a few more minutes here. Let's see. Jan says, people sometimes argue in support of the smoking ban in pubs, where it's still legal, that the pub owners would love to ban it, but they would lose customers. But if all pubs are forced to ban it, they won't lose customers because they will have nowhere else to go. What's wrong with this argument? Okay, that's good. You're right, and it's because you're using the word pub, I'm assuming you're not in the United States, but I've heard people say that in the U.S. also. I'm trying to think of if there's a really good analogy I can use. Well, the thing is, I mean, it's still, I mean, for one thing, Jan, you could say that about anything, right? You could say the government could pass a law where the bar owner punches people in the face when they walk in the door. And you could justify the exact same thing and say, no individual bar owner who punches customers in the face when they walk in because he'd go out of business. They would all just go somewhere else that didn't have that policy. But yet, if the government passed the law, then all bars, the owners had to, you know, have the bouncer punch people when they walked in. That could work. You know, it's not that any one bar would go out of business because, you know, everybody would, there'd be no reason to go to one bar or another because, you know, formally implied. And it's true, the total number of customers going to bars would go down, but that's also true with the smoking ban. Fewer people go out to bars when they know that it's illegal to smoke in any of the bars. We say, well, not really. Jan, I don't know. Okay, I don't know the exact numbers in England, but I'm saying it's, you could adjust the argument that if they punched every 10th person who came in and didn't hit them too hard, it might not change it either. All right. So, and also it's in the U.S. I mean, I have seen studies that it did change a little bit, at least in certain areas, because people, they would like stay home or they would go to other places and they would go to places that illegally let them smoke. All right. So there's that issue also. Okay, but in any event, so I mean that's saying one thing is just the logic of the argument, strictly speaking, by itself is not enough. Now, of course, you can go through and say, well, give me a break. The idea is that smoking is bad for people, and so we're trying to get them to do something that they really kind of want to do anyway, so there's a paternalistic argument involved. All right, so that's, you know, there's that element as well. I think though, Jan, that it's, I mean, it does come down to if there are, how can I put it? If there really is this need, you know, people saying we don't want to be in places where I don't want to be exposed to smoke. In other words, who is it that's supporting the ban? You get what I'm asking? That if the public is saying, no, you know, I want to be able to go to a bar and not be exposed to smoke, well, then it is kind of weird to say, oh, but if any individual bar established a policy saying there's no smoking here, then that bar would go out of business. Well, then it must not really be that, there must not be that many people that it's really that big a deal. All right, so it's that kind of issue as well. All right. Okay, there's something bouncing around in my head, Jan. I can't put my finger on it. There was some empirical result, again, not in England. I was familiar with studies done in the United States, and unfortunately, I can't put my finger on it, though, that was very relevant to this exact question you're asking, and it's probably not going to come to me in the next 2 minutes. Okay. I mean, it's all like to switch the argument. It's kind of like with a lot of these things where people will propose some sort of government intervention that is apparently so universally accepted that, oh, come on, who but a crazy libertarian could oppose that? And it's like, well, wait a minute. If it's so universally accepted that no decent, civilized person would object to it, well, then why do we need to force it on everybody? You know, it's kind of like sending your kids to school or, you know, things saying, oh, come on, who could be against a law forcing kids to go to school? Because in this day and age, you know, we know how important it is to society for children to be educated. It's like, well, okay, well, if 99% of us all agree we want to live in a society where we want to send the kids should all go to school, well, then we know at least 99% of the kids are going to go to school voluntarily because we will send our kids to school. So it's kind of weird. Or like with vaccination too, that it's – with vaccination in particular, that one's really funny where, you know, the idea is, oh, come on, we all – you know, overwhelming consensus is vaccination is a good idea. And so who but just a, you know, troglodyte, stick-in-the-mud nut job could oppose it, and that's why we should force everyone to get it because it's such a reasonable thing. There's such consensus. Like, well, okay, if there's such a consensus, then you don't need to force it. The vast overwhelming majority will voluntarily get it, and then with vaccination in particular, the whole point is if you get vaccinated, you're not supposed to be vulnerable. Right? So it's primarily the people who, in your mind, stupidly don't get vaccinated that are the ones that are going to be in danger. And okay, so let's see. Okay, how about one more? And I'll let you guys go. Don says, if government spending could be reduced low enough, would a tariff on imported goods be the least distorting revenue source? That's a really tricky question, Don, because there's all kinds of things that we need, the assumptions we would have to make. So I think most tax economists would tell you no, that it's kind of artificial to be trying to raise all the revenue from foreign goods as opposed to goods produced domestically. That's a very artificial distinction. Why would we do it that way? I think most tax economists in the field would say the best thing is to have a flat, uniform tax on consumption, that is the least distorting. Another possibility, if it's low enough, is to just say a head tax. It's just everybody in the country owes $80 a year. Boom. I don't care how much money you make. I don't care what you spend your money on. Just everybody, if you're in the United States, we're talking about the U.S., you owe the IRS $80 a year, and then we live on that. You know, that would be even less distorting. Okay, but then you get into issues of enforcement, and the benefit of a tariff is they just kind of have to monitor the border or the I'm drawing a blank where this stuff comes, the ports where stuff comes in, and so they just had to have customs agents there, and there's only, you know, a few choke points. Whereas if you have something like a head tax or a consumption tax, then everyone's got data and the government has information on everybody, and so that's bad just for privacy reasons and stuff like that too. Right? So it depends what you're throwing in there. Yeah, a lot of politically conservative people, classical liberals, might like what you're saying because they don't want direct taxes on the American people. But in terms of just the pure economics of it, if we're not worrying about the threat of Big Brother and stuff like that, and if we're not worrying so much about the administrative collection cost, but just looking at the pure logic of it, I think a lot of economists would say, no, actually, that's an artificial, like, why would you say something coming from Japan ought to be taxed, whereas something coming from Alaska shouldn't be? That's kind of weird. Okay, so let me stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. And, oh, just so you know, I am going to be traveling this upcoming Thursday. There was a chance I wasn't going to be, but now I am. So I think the best thing is I'm going to record the lecture 3 beforehand. I'll put it on my YouTube channel and give it to you guys. You know, I'm not going to promote it. I'll keep it among you guys during this course. Okay, so you'd be looking for that. You will see that YouTube lecture when I get it posted.